KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I welcome you and thank you for listening in today. Today, I continue a back-to-back show involving issues regarding privacy. Last week, we had the pleasure of talking to and listening to the comments and analysis of Chris Hufnagel at Berkeley regarding privacy issues. Today, I'm very pleased to have on with me a guest of equal repute and equal reputation in the field of privacy, Lauren Gelman. Continuing my run of interviewing everyone that I can affiliated with the Center for Internet and Society, Lauren is the Associate Director of CIS, where she writes and speaks about the interaction of new technologies and the law, and represents clients in a wide range of matters involving privacy and technology issues, and does a host of things involved in running CIS. She received a Bachelor of Science in Biology and Society from Cornell, a master's degree in science, technology, and public policy from George Washington, and yes, of course, a law degree from Georgetown. She served on various panels, including the Transportation Security Administration, Secure Flight Working Group, and sits on other boards relating to issues involving privacy and technology. This is an issue that continues to be of prime importance to people, that whether they're using technology on a daily basis or using technology on a limited basis, because privacy issues themselves have entered the forefront in every kinds of transaction that you might conduct on the internet, as well as any information that you might share publicly or information that you might share with a third party. And it runs the gamut from issues relating to everything from blogging about your employer to employee rights to the AT&T case, which has been in the press quite a bit, to pretexting, which we discussed last week with Chris and which we'll continue discussing today. Lauren herself, because of her background dealing with the advocacy side of these issues, has pretty unique insights on what's happening on the policy side and where things are going, and so I'll look forward to discussing those issues with her, as well as issues involving the really challenging issues of network neutrality. So I'm very excited to have Lauren here today and very excited to continue the discussion relating to privacy, getting her perspective on where we are. Lauren, are you there?
I am. Thank you, David.
Thanks for walking over to the studio and talking today about these issues. Let's start right off with kind of a core question. I introduced you a little bit, but one of the organizations with which you've been most involved is EFF. Why don't you tell us a little bit about EFF and how they're involved, and perhaps lead into how you got interested in these issues?
Right. Well, I got interested in these issues. I'm going to start with that.
I'll take your
last question first.
There we go, like quiz show.
Exactly. I got interested in these issues coming out of college in 1995 because I, at that time, was a user of very early versions of the internet and was very interested in science and technology and how they got integrated into society, and was very interested in a lot of the privacy issues. In fact, the privacy issues were really what first brought me to cyber law, because it was really interesting, the idea that you could email and send messages to people and those messages would stay around in a way that's very different than, you know, the kind of getting a letter and then throwing that away. And so I started working in D.C. in 95, doing advocacy on these issues. And I started working with EFF in, I think it was about 1999, as their policy director. And EFF is the Electronic Frontier Foundation, on the web at EFF.org. And they are the preeminent civil liberties organization that focuses on internet and new technologies. So they work on everything from voting rights cases to free speech cases to privacy issues to copyright. They have been at the forefront in the protection of people's rights to use music and to remix and a wide variety of different issues. So They're just a bunch of hardworking, low-paid attorneys trying to do their best to keep the internet free for the rest of us. And I had the privilege of working with them, for them, and now still work closely with them on a number of different cases.
The privacy, especially now, has become such a hot-button issue because of the prevalence of technology and how people communicate with companies and governments and people with whom they're supposed to have a special relationship. Because of your background looking at these issues for a number of years, I'm curious to ask kind of what is what will sound like a very broad question, but how, when someone would ask you, why is this an issue? Why should I be concerned about privacy on the internet? What's your response to that question?
Well, the way the technology has changed, it has taken information that was previously available just in libraries or archives or in your house and made it accessible on the web to everybody. So the technology has really affected this transformation in people's privacy rights without the law having to change at all. So you have records that were previously only located in courthouses and now are available on the web to anybody who can search through Google. You have your friends taking pictures of you whenever you're out and posting them on Flickr. You have all these different technologies, and database storage has become very cheap. So companies store information for infinite amounts of time. Databases have become smarter. They talk to each other. So when Amazon collects your information using one database, they can exchange that information and trade that information with Barnes & Noble, who collects information using a different database. And so you can collaborate and put all this information together to create what Dan Solov has called your digital dossier, or a description of your life online. And this gives a lot of information about you. So it's not just about in the brick and mortar world where one company knew what kind of business you did with them. But now, as the information is exchanged digitally, saved in these large databases, you have many companies out there knowing everything about you. And this is a real transformation.
The privacy issues that seem to be most prevalent, I think, in people's minds have to deal with situations where information that they thought was going to be held private becomes public. And that's the most stark example. But we know that there are a host of issues dealing with privacy that are really, for, you know, pardon the pun of sorts, but under the radar, as it were. I want to talk about a few of those, some more prevalent than others. I started off the conversation last week with Chris on the issue of pretexting, which continues to be in the, you know, front page news. And it's not that often that you have privacy issues like this becoming, you know, top of the fold, you know, above the fold stories in the New York Times and the LA Times and the Wall Street Journal and everywhere else. I asked Chris last week, and I'll ask you the same question. We know what pretexting is, and I think we have a general understanding of what it's about. But let's start off with this. Why is it, in your opinion, that pretexting has become apparently a very prevalent practice? The idea of getting private information from phone companies and other places, apparently using what I termed and discussed with Chris last week, amounts to fraud. But why do you think it's become, appears to be a method of gathering information that is being used by companies at the top of the food chain like HP?
Well, pretexting has been around for a while. I think that, you know, whether you call it, you can call it pretexting, you can call it social engineering, using faking information about yourself in order to get information from a third party is not new. Probably the cavemen were doing it. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that's different is the role intermediaries play in society today. So phone companies have always had information about the numbers that you call and the numbers who call you. But now AT&T can also be your email provider, your ISP, and also have a lot more information about now who you're emailing. Or as your ISP, they might know information about what you're doing on the web. So I think this whole idea of The culture we live in, we're giving so much of our information to third parties so that they can provide a service to us. And when we lose control over that, other people can go to those third parties and try to get information. And this is something I deal with regularly, whether it's the government trying to get that information or civil subpoenas to try to get that information or pretexters, people just trying to social engineer in order to get that information. It's really all the same underlying issue, which is that I don't have control over who I call and who calls me. The phone company does. And so the pretexter goes to the phone company to get that information.
Is it as simple an issue as the reason why the problem is more prevalent is because of the amount of ways that one could go about getting the private information? I mean, you mentioned that the idea of getting information by fraudulent means has been around for a long time. Is the problem more pronounced now simply because it's easier to do it? Is that what it boils down to?
You know, I'm gonna argue with your premise.
Okay.
I think that it's more public because of what happened with HP.
Okay.
So that brings it to the cover of news stories. But you know, people like Chris have been working for a really long time to try to get these practices stopped. So we have an entire private investigator industry out there that eats on pretexting cases. Pretexting is most often used in divorce cases where you're trying to get records from the phone company about whether your cheating spouse is calling their lover in order to get a better settlement. So I think that a lot of privacy issues tend to hide underneath the radar until there's a big blowout that brings to the forefront the nature of what's going on. And so my sense is that pretexting is not something that's particularly new. I think there's more information out there pretexters can get because of intermediaries, but I also think pretexters have been doing this for a really long time.
I had said to Chris last week that really for me this amounts to nothing more than straight up fraud, and that I would even term these people fraudsters. Is that fair? Do you think that that's a fair terminology to use for this practice, or is there something different going on here in terms of how the information is gathered and what means they use to get it?
Well, you know, I think that it's wrong. I think it's a crime. I think that there's a lot of different statutes out there that that prevent this kind of activity. And I think there's a lot of ways that you can go after the private investigators for doing it. I think there's, you know, a separate question about whether you can go after HP if they knew about it. And I think there's a really important question in getting Congress and the state governments to pass legislation explicitly addressing this practice, because we can speculate on the kinds of ways you can go after the pretexters, but the best way to go after them would be if there was a law that said you can't do this. And I think we should all be able to agree that this is not a practice that should be allowed. In particular, that HP use these private investigators to get call records from journalists. I know, and this is a part of the what's been going on that I don't think has gotten enough attention, because you know there's so much interest in protecting journalists and their sources and the benefit to society that comes when information flows. And here you have HP under the auspices of a woman who was once a journalist authorizing private investigators to get phone records of journalists to see who they're talking to. So this is just a despicable practice, and I am extremely hopeful that the result of this HP thing will be that we'll get some good laws outlawing it.
And Chris had thought that it would be a federal law that would be the most effective. Is that your sense of where it needs to go in terms of the legislation?
Yeah, I think federal law is the best option, and there's an aspect of federal law that prevents pretexting for financial information. And I think that, you know, there's reason to hope that some states might pass some law if the federal government doesn't, and that will incentivize the federal government to step in and deal with it. You know, the laws that are out there right now can be used to go after these guys, but you know, they have some problems. Like, for example, what's the monetary gain that came to these private investigators from getting the information? So there's a question about using a fraud analysis in these cases.
Mm-hmm. It's it's just like in the world of internet gaming, something that I've focused on. Certainly, the proponents of the people that are looking to ban it say, "Well, you've got the Wire Act, and you've got these different very old laws that you could somehow bootstrap into banning gaming. But let's just have a law that says you can't do it." And from a legislative standpoint, that makes perfect sense. Let me turn your attention to a related issue, which is another case that's been front page news, although maybe it's been pushed off the front pages a bit, which is the case involving AT&T and their sharing of information with the government. For those who are not familiar, maybe you could give a brief summary of what that case is about and why it's a major privacy issue.
Right. So, well, since 9/11, there has been speculation and some good reporting and some admissions by the government that they have been getting information directly from the phone companies. And this, we believe, has been done without a warrant.
Hmm.
When the government wants to get content information from a phone company like AT&T, they have to show up with a piece of paper because the law says you need a warrant or you need some other piece of paper, depending on the kind of information you're asking for, that explicitly a judge has looked at it and said it's okay, we agree as the judicial branch that AT&T should turn over the information. And the particular case you're talking about, which is the case that EFF is litigating against AT&T, it's a class action lawsuit. They're representing all people who are AT&T customers, and they're alleging that AT&T has a secret room. And in it, they are turning over all the content that comes through their system directly to the NSA. And one of the interesting things that has happened here is the government has said, yes, we're doing this, but there is a question about whose information is being turned over and whether there was this official piece of paper or a signed letter by the Attorney General or some document that authorized AT&T to turn over the information.
The challenge here, it seems, is one of basically ignoring normal procedure to obtain the right to invade one's privacy. And is that simplifying it too much?
That's part of the problem. But another part of the problem is that there actually is no piece of paper out there that allows what the government is doing. So we basically say that when we have particularized suspicion that somebody is doing something wrong, the government can go in and, whether it's using the normal courts or using even secret courts, they can get the content of this person's communications. This is an important part of how the government stops crime and solves crime, and we have judges that oversee this. What we don't have is any ability for the government to say, I want all the phone calls of a whole wide-ranging list of people, none of whom I have any particularized suspicion that they've actually done something wrong. I just want to know who they're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
So the situation would be something like they find a phone book in a cave in Afghanistan, and now they want to tap every phone number in that book. Or they find that same phone book in a house or in a car or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or they find a computer and they want to get the emails of everybody who's on this list, whether you're somebody who just happened to spam this person or whether you're somebody who might actually be in cahoots with them.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have legal documents because we have a system that says that people are innocent until proven guilty. We have a system that says you have to have some particularized information someone's doing something wrong before you can wiretap them. And what the government would like to be able to do is say to AT&T, give us all the information, all the content that's coming through your system, and we'll then decide whether or not it's useful.
The challenging issue here, obviously, whenever you bring in the specter of a book, a theoretical book sitting in Afghanistan as the issue of national security. And obviously that was the main argument that the government made in justifying this behavior. And of course, that's the argument in a, basically that the president is making right now whenever he publicly comments on this. Let me ask you what, you know, the tough question that I think challenges everyone thinking about these issues, which is how you balance privacy and national security interests. Let me take your hypothetical a step further and get a sense of what your reaction is. So let's say you have this book found in the cave in Afghanistan, and there's reason to think in this hypothetical world that that book is directly connected to bin Laden. It's a book of potential members of al-Qaeda. Why should it be that the government shouldn't be able to say that in and of itself is enough for us to do what we need to do? Now, aside from the procedural question, which to me is obvious, which is that we have a government that involves the rule of law, and that the law therefore applies to every search warrant and every effort to invade this information, regardless of how sensitive it is, whether you go to the FISA secret courts, which have a handful of published opinions that anyone can read, or whether you go into a public court where anyone could sit. What would you say is the privacy concern ultimately in that situation, and how do you balance that against national security interests?
Well, I guess what I would say is that in every case, I think if the executive branch has a strong interest in being both in the being the people that investigate crimes and prosecute crimes, and it is just good for democracy to have another branch, the judiciary branch, overseeing that process. So if bin Laden's telephone book is found and there are people in there, it is my guess that it is worthwhile for the executive to go through the process of getting the judiciary to approve the warrants so that they can get that information or whatever kind of legal document is required. I think that's a big step away from saying to AT&T, give us all of your content that's flowing through your wires, because somewhere in there might be terrorist communications. Mm-hmm. So the people who are opposed to this program have never said that the government should never be allowed to get the content of communications. What they've said is that just because we are in a, you know, so-called war on terror and we are facing threats, we don't give up the basic liberties and the basic tenets of our Constitution, which say we have three branches, they're co-equal, there's oversight between them, and that's what gives us our freedom. So I think that what's particularly offensive about this case is both that the government didn't have a legal tool that they needed, and instead of going to Congress to get Congress to give them that legal tool, or instead of going to the courts to try to get it approved through the courts, they just went directly to AT&T and said, give us this information, and AT&T simply turned it over without any double guessing or questioning the government. Mm-hmm. So my view is that there was space for both Congress or the judiciary to come in and approve what the president wanted to do. And instead of going to either of those co-equal branches, he went directly to AT&T. And that's just not something that's acceptable. I don't care, you know, what the risk is. The risk to our democracy is greater than any other risk out there.
I think it's one of those issues where you could see just in the Machiavellian sense, if you have a situation where the government wants information and they could sidestep the middleman, which in this case is the courts, and get a party to simply waive on behalf of their own customers their privacy interests, then you could see someone saying, let's just do that and deal with the consequences later. Before we go to a music break, I kind of want to ask you almost a question that tends to be asked more in a high school fight than it does here, but who's worse in this situation, in your opinion? Is it AT&T, who had the responsibility to, I think, to maintain a certain level of fiduciary concern when it comes to the privacy of their customers? Or is it the government who, although they have justifications for what they did, ultimately decided that this was the route that they could take under the rubric of national security? I mean, it's a question that doesn't really solve anything, but I'm curious to get your sense of who's really the ultimate culprit here.
Right. You know, I don't know who's worse, but I certainly could say that, you know, the people in government who are trying to get this information, you know, that is their job. And, you know, they do it because they want to keep us safe. AT&T is, as you say, our representative in this fight. I mean, as we sort of started the conversation off when we started talking about intermediaries, here AT&T is the party that has this information about me. And I both trust that they aren't going to turn it over. And there's laws out there that Congress has passed, particularly because intermediaries sit between us and the government. And it's AT&T's responsibility to say no. Not only that, there is a secret court. AT&T could have gone to the secret court and said, we're being asked to do this. Is this right? So, as a civil libertarian and as an advocate in this space, I find it weird arguing about how the AT&T did wrong by not going to a secret court. You know, right. I'm not a big fan of secret courts generally, yeah, but to the extent that we do have one, you would hope that it would be used in situations like this, and that there would have been lawyers at AT&T who were squeamish about participating in this program. So I do think, if I had to pick the worst party, I would say the government at least is doing what they're supposed to be doing and trying to prosecute crime, although I don't approve of their methods. Whereas AT&T is, there's no justification for them to have not sought out some way to determine the legal status of this request before just turning over the information.
It's certainly a plausible position, and I'm inclined to agree. And I think it's also a topic that I'd love to continue discussing, maybe on a future show, as this case progresses. But let's take a short music break now. When we come back, I want to touch on a couple of other issues that get down to the meta level of people's day-to-day activities. So when we return, we will continue talking to Lauren Gelman, the Associate Director of CIS, the Center for Internet and Society. You are listening to KZSU Stanford, Dave Levine, and Hearsay Culture. Before we get back to Lauren, I just wanted to do what I've done weekly at the bottom of the hour, roughly, and ask you whether you like what you're hearing. And then after you honk your horns, I would ask you to help make sure that KZSU can continue providing great programs without commercials to listeners all over the Bay Area. You can donate to KZSU. For more information, email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And don't forget to keep on listening. So we're back with Lauren Gelman. And Lauren, why don't we turn to issues that are more related to people's day-to-day life. And let's talk a little bit about the world of blogging and the challenges that bloggers have. You did a very interesting talk just yesterday on State of Play Academy, which I'll let you chat about at the end, because I think it's an interesting venue for these types of discussions. But I want to, you know, kind of talk in that same area. The employee in particular who wants to blog about their employer runs into a ton of issues, both practical and legal. The practical often being that they're running the risk of angering their employer, and the employer may take some kind of penalty type action against them, whether it's demotion or firing or what have you. But there's also privacy concerns. So let's talk a little bit about that. What are the employer's rights, if any, to control what is said about them by their employees?
Well, people, including employees, have, you know, First Amendment rights to say whatever they think, unless there's another law out there that prevents them from saying a specific thing. So, for example, copyright law is, you know, the law that prevents us from saying what somebody said first. And employers can exercise, for example, trade secret protection over information or trademark or other types of protections over the information of the company. And so if the employee discloses that information and they were under an obligation to keep it secret, then they can be violating their employer's rights, and the employer can actually sue them for that.
The cases that deal with this stuff you often read about, and they come up like periodically in the press, and the basic scenario, hypothetical, but happens, is the employee that decides to either blog about or write about something negative involving their employer. And the employer comes back and says either this is, as you're mentioning, is some kind of secret, and therefore they wind up being in a position, the blogger, of having to decide whether they're going to continue exercising their rights, which they perceive to have under the First Amendment, or whether they are going to accede to these concerns involving privacy. My question here is, where is the line drawn, in your opinion, between what information is private and what isn't when it comes to blogs?
Right. Okay. So first I want to clarify something that I said before, because
okay.
The First Amendment only applies vis-a-vis the government. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't apply. You don't have a First Amendment right against your lawyer. Mm-hmm. I should say that you can say whatever you want, but there are very specific things you cannot say.
Right.
But your employer can certainly fire you if they don't like what you said. So they can't sue you for saying what you think, but they can fire you for saying what you think.
Mm-hmm.
The government, if you work for the government, it's actually a lot harder for them to fire you for saying what you think. If what you think is about the government,
it's
creates
a public concern.
Yeah,
right.
It creates a different kinds of questions, but mm-hmm. I just wanted to speak correctly.
Fair enough.
So the issue of, privacy for bloggers or for employer? What?
Well, the employer facing the situation where someone is blogging about them.
Yeah, I think one of the very interesting things that the internet has done is it's taken control out of the company's purview and marketing departments and PR departments and put it in the hands of their employees. So as we discussed last night, things said around the water cooler can now be said on the internet and listened to and heard by the entire world. So I think that, employers have a privacy interest in educating their employees in how something they say can hurt the company, because most of the cases are where an employee is saying something that they don't realize is going to hurt the company. And if they just had a little bit of education for the company from the company, then they wouldn't do it. So if they say they're leaving to go to a certain place and it turns out that may be Redmond and that might give some information about a deal with Microsoft that the company doesn't want disclosed, then a little bit of education can go a long way. The situation where the employee is blogging or speaking about the employer badly and is doing so on purpose is a different can of beans. And I think that employers have the ability to fire people. There's no protection for bloggers to prevent an employer from firing them. And I think that bloggers need to sort of be smart about how they handle this. So, either you could tell your employer what you're doing is one way to go, or you can blog anonymously or post anonymously to message boards, and that's another way to go. I think it's very unfortunate when companies try to prevent their employees from speaking. I think the top-down control model is not sustainable in an internet age, but I think a lot of companies still adopt it. And I think people say things on the internet that they shouldn't. So, the walk away is it's a balancing, and companies and employees getting used to the digital age, and people shouldn't say things on the internet they wouldn't want on the front page of the New York Times, and companies should be first, quickly work to educate employees and that instead of being quick to fire them.
It's and I think what it turns on is that, in my opinion, is that latter point, which is that the internet and these blogs have the potential to become the loose cannon that you can't control. And I think, the same kind of issues come up in a related but not similar situation involving emails that people send, imagining that they're just talking to another person in the hallway, and an email comes back to haunt them years later, perhaps in litigation, in a fight where they say, well, you said this on an email, and there's something you would never put on the front page of the Times or even say outside of your office, but you sent it to your colleague, and somehow that you perceive that to be more private than otherwise. Let me, in the time that we have left, I would be remiss in not asking you about some of the policy issues and the stuff going on in Washington involving these issues. Your experience working in Washington for EFF and dealing with this stuff throws out an obvious question, which is, what's your sense of Washington's sensitivity to, particularly Congress's sensitivity to these privacy issues that we've discussed today? Where do you think we are right now?
Well, I think we're nowhere. I mean, I think that that Congress has passed a number of different quote-unquote privacy legislation. We have what academics call the silo approach to privacy in this country, which is, instead of having a law that protects our privacy, we have a law that protects medical privacy, a law that protects financial privacy, a law that protects video rental privacy. And none of them are very good. And companies do a lot of business sharing information about people. And it's very hard to pass good legislation to protect people. So it turns out you end up needing something like this HP case to bring pretexting to the forefront to hopefully get some legislation. Another good example is all the cases about data leaks where companies have lost data. There's been some movement in Congress to try to pass some legislation putting some responsibility on the companies to protect the data against these leaks. You would think that would be an obvious thing, but, you know, companies argue that, you know, we can't afford the liability, we won't be able to do business. So I think there's a lot to be pessimistic about in terms of looking to Congress to protect our privacy.
The one thing that Chris and I were chatting about last week, which is one of the unfortunate ironies here, is that it's been the government that have been the front page story on a number of data leaks recently. You know, the lost laptop computers that contain Social Security numbers and other types of sensitive information. And so in some ways, you're asking an entity that itself has a hard time controlling data to come up with good ways to control data, and furthermore to impose it on everyone else. Congress has had the unfortunate role oftentimes of passing laws that it exempts itself from, and has been criticized at times for it. But I want to follow up on your pessimism by asking whether, for lack of a better phrase, whether it's possible that humiliation can play a role here, where the issue becomes almost so laughable in some people's minds, the idea that this information is just out there and no one's controlling it, that there could be almost a shame effect, which occasionally has worked when it comes to a lot of public policy issues, to just literally say, look at all of these different things that are happening at the same time. You've got to get a handle on it. And if Congress doesn't, who?
Right. I mean, that's... And that's what's needed is the killer app for something really bad happening to people's privacy. So as the numbers of identity thefts increase, or, you know, people's information are spilled and bad things happen, I mean, I'm horrified to be put in the position of hoping for something bad to happen to people in order for Congress to wake up. But, you know, it's not just Congress's fault. It's the public's fault, because the public gives away lots of information about itself in order to get free stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, we sign up for a free ice cream cone by telling them when our birthday is and where we live and all sorts of other information, and this information is exchanged. So I think there's a point at which companies are being negligent with that information, and that needs to be stopped. But I think also there needs to be some education. And part of what I always think of the problem with privacy is, you don't experience the harm at the time you do something bad for yourself. So you sign up for a new credit card, or you allow information to flow from one party to another, and you don't read the privacy policy of the website that you're doing business with. And then, you know, a year from now, maybe identity theft can happen, but there's no immediate harm that comes from doing something bad. So I think this is one of the reasons why it's an area ripe and appropriate for legislation. But I hope that people will consider it one of their priorities. Everybody always says they care about privacy, but you have to also follow through in your actions.
Well, you couldn't have given me a better segue for the next question, which is, how do people follow through? What do you recommend would be good places for people to start, both to learn more about these issues and, as you say, follow through on them?
Right. Well, you know, the first thing I would say that you should that's just a very easy thing to think about, which is you should never give out your Social Security number. And if somebody's asking you for your Social Security number, you should question why. And certainly if it's for, you know, the last four digits of your Social Security number, you shouldn't give that information out. You shouldn't give that information out in connection with your mother's maiden name. I think there's just some general pieces of information out there that are so widely spread that they associate directly back to you. Things that are going to make your life easier, sometimes you should remember you are giving up your privacy. You're selling your information in order to get something that makes your life easier. So when somebody's trying to pitch you on something being free in exchange for giving up your information, it's not free. And, you know, some good resources for this are, you know, the EFF has a great website. The Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, epic.org, has a good website. There's a great Privacy Rights Coalition, PRC, I'm pretty sure it is. They have a great website. So there's a number of different places out there that you can find out a lot of information.
And in terms of
Privacy Rights Clearinghouse.
Privacy Rights Clearinghouse.
Yeah.
And eventually, by the way, I'm going to be having a website where I'll be able to say, okay, here are the links for people. But I'm working on that. So beyond what people can do to protect themselves, I guess before we close the show, what do you see? Pretexting obviously is clearly on the front page. Are there any? What do you see as one or two other, in the minute that we have, other two privacy issues you see coming down the pike that people should be aware of?
Right. Well, I think the issues that have come up recently with AOL posting on the Internet people's search results, and a case where Google was asked to turn over search queries to the government, there was a lot of uproar about that. And I think that things like this, where information that you gave to a website, like your search terms or something like that, with the understanding that it was just between you and your website, and now that information gets posted elsewhere, I think those are going to be the kinds of things that are wake-up calls for people. And everything to do with the idea that, you know, Google has a lot of business models around, you give us all your data, you give us all your documents, and we'll help you search them. We'll store them on our computers, and we'll help you search them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, think about that. I mean, you're giving them all of your documents. And when it's the government or a divorce case or any of the other cases that come along, they're an intermediary. You're giving them this information. You lose control over it. So I think as we turn more of our information over to third parties and lose that control, it's going to raise a lot of privacy issues that we're going to have to deal with.
Lauren, I want to thank you for coming in today and having this discussion, which I think has been very insightful and really kind of, I think, it certainly sparked in me more of an interest in what's happening because of really putting it into concrete terms of the idea that people are just going out and willfully stealing your private information under the ruse of being a detective or something else. I think that alone is enough for people to pay more attention. So thank you for coming today. And before you go, I made this brief mention of the State of Play Academy, and why don't I give you an opportunity to describe quickly what that is and where you can find out about it, and mention any other sites that you'd like to mention at this time.
Thank you, David. State of Play Academy is a new project that I'm working on, and a big goal we have is to democratize legal education, so make talks about legal issues available to the general public. It takes place in a virtual world in there.com. So you sign in and you have your avatar, which you can customize to make look like you or not like you, depending on what you prefer. And you can come walk your avatar into our classroom. It's voice enabled, so you can participate by voice or you can text. There's paintball, and you can run around and shoot each other with paintballs.
And I've been guilty of
that. We don't advise that during our classes, and
I haven't done.
It's a fun time to try to understand what's going on with virtual worlds, as well as an opportunity to learn more. And we have another class on blogging and liability tomorrow evening, 5:30 Pacific time. Find out more at stateofplayacademy.com. I'm also going to plug one other thing, which is I'm talking tomorrow night on the Stanford campus about network neutrality, and it's being organized by planetwork.net. And you can go to that website and find out more and learn about what's happening in Washington with the network neutrality debate.
Terrific. And I'll be talking on State of Play next week about my I've written an article on trade secrets and public infrastructure, which I'm going to be discussing at the State of Play Academy. So I certainly encourage anyone who wants to see my avatar, which, by the way, for those not technically inclined, is basically your graphical representation of yourself. And mine looks nothing like me, but I think it's fun.
Avatar has an afro.
Yes, I have an afro, which with my hair would be impossible to grow. But it is an interesting and worthwhile environment to consider. And like Lauren said, it is interesting to, and kind of really an unusual experience to have a very substantive discussion about law, in this virtual world. But, that's another topic I think we could discuss in more detail, at a later date. So I want to thank Lauren Gelman, the Associate Director of the Center for Internet and Society, for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I'm going to take a short music break, and when I return, I will close the show. So I want to thank Lauren Gelman for coming in and discussing privacy issues and First Amendment issues as well here on Hearsay Culture. Again, my name is Dave Levine, and I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. And this is a weekly show that I do at 5 o'clock Pacific Standard Time here on KZSU. Coming up in a few minutes is Your Imaginary Friend and Brownie in Motion. My show will continue to be running at 5 o'clock for the foreseeable future. Next week, I'm pleased to have on Jack Lerner from Berkeley, who will be discussing an issue that music fans would be interested in, which is the world of sampling in particular. And so Jack will be here live next week at 5. I'm also going to be interviewing, coming up, Chris Sprigman, who is a professor of law at the University of Virginia, and who's written a very interesting piece on the use of copyright law in fashion, as well as some other stuff. So I'm looking forward to talking to Chris. But I do encourage you to take a look at State of Play and State of Play Academy and see what you think of it. I also want to mention that for those of you who just can't get enough and want to see me in person, I'm going to be speaking about the article that I mentioned on trade secrets and public infrastructure, not only on their.com next week, but I'll be doing a talk at Stanford Law School in mid-October, and I'll give you more information on that as the date approaches. But I encourage you to come to that, and also, of course, to check out what's going on at Stanford and particularly at the Center for Internet and Society by going to CIS's webpage, which is cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Again, cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Now that the semester has begun, there are a lot of talks that occur around the lunch hour and other times that are really fascinating and, again, touch on these technology issues. And, of course, there's so much going on at Stanford University generally that if you are and do have the ability to come by and see some of these talks, it's definitely worth your time. Of course, as far as CIS goes, our talks are also made available on iTunes by going to the iTunes program and typing in Center for Internet and Society under podcasts. You'll find my show as well as other talks at CIS. And then finally, I am coming more close to launching Hearsay Culture's webpage, which once it's ready to go live, I will give out the address, and I encourage you to check that out as well. So thank you for listening today to Hearsay Culture, and stay tuned for Brownie in Motion and Your Imaginary Friend. And so we'll close with Dusty Trails, and thanks again. Have a good evening.